We're actually looking at the golden age of Israel now, and it began with King David, and now we're continuing on with the story of Solomon. And last week we saw that Solomon took over his reign. David has died, and God appeared to Solomon, and we thought that was kind of interesting because we discovered last week that Israel was worshiping in high places, and kind of red flags went all over for us because we go, what is Israel worshiping in high places for? Because God had said they were not to do that. And we discovered that at this point in history, it's a little different. It said Israel was worshiping in the high places because the temple was not built yet. And we discovered that one of the most holy high places actually had the tabernacle that Moses had built. And so we had Israel worshiping at the tabernacle, but the tabernacle had been rescued when the Philistines came against Shiloh. So the only thing we have there is the tabernacle, and only one piece of furniture is mentioned. That's the bronze laver. So we've got that in Gibeon. And Solomon went there, and he worshiped to the Lord and offered 1,000 sacrifices, thanking the Lord for making him king. And we know that God approved him worshiping at the high place because God appeared to him that night in a dream or in a vision, which was a common way that God spoke to his people in the Old Testament. And God said that he could ask whatever he wanted and he would do it for him. It was a way that God could see what was in Solomon's heart. And when Solomon asked God, it was for wisdom, not for himself, but that he could judge God's people rightly. And it said God was pleased, and that he said not only would he give him a discerning heart, which include wisdom and understanding, but also wealth, power, and honor, and if he continued to follow God's law, long life. It was interesting because following that, he went and worshiped the Lord in Jerusalem. And we discovered that the Ark of the Covenant is not part of the tabernacle. David had moved that, so it was actually in the city of Jerusalem in a different tent. And Solomon there goes and worships the Lord there. So we see the problem is we've got the tabernacle of God in Gibeon, and then we've got the Ark of the Covenant in Jerusalem. So David's desire was to bring everything together, and that has been passed on now till Solomon. Following Solomon's request for wisdom and God's answer, the story continues by showing us his wisdom. This is very early in his life. And the first case that's given to us is a very interesting one. It's two prostitutes. They have access to come before the king to do the judgment. Now, the way it would have been in the courts, prostitutes generally lived in cities. It was a forbidden practice in Israel. And yet, obviously, it was going on. Their first court of appeals, if you will, or place to take it to the court, would be the city gates. And the city gates, their rooms where the elders would sit and hold court, or any business dealings that were going on. And you could bring your concerns to them, and they would judge it. But this is an exceedingly difficult case. And so it was passed from that, probably to Jerusalem. Jerusalem had a court of appeals, which included the Levites, the priests, and the elders. And so they would have probably gone there with their concern. And yet, again, they couldn't handle this case. And so the case then finally went to the king, which in our case would be like taking it all the way to the Supreme Court. According to Josephus, there was a lot of interest in this case because it was exceedingly difficult because there's no witnesses. It's one woman's word against another woman's word. And how are you going to solve that dilemma? So the courtroom, or Solomon's chambers, are packed that day. And these two women come in, and Solomon inquires what their case is, and the first woman presents the case. You read it today in your story. Basically, two women had babies. No witnesses, they were alone. Josephus says the babies were born at the same time, and this event occurred 3 days later. Some of the translations said the babies were born 3 days apart. But however it was, in the night, one of the women rolled over on her baby and killed him. Realizing it, she switched the babies in the night. And this woman, when she awoke to nurse her child, realized that the child was dead, but didn't know until the morning when the light came up that it was not her child. So she's saying, the live baby is mine, the dead is hers. Now, whether Solomon turned to the second woman and asked hers, or whether she interrupted, she begins by saying, no, what she said is not true. The live baby is really mine, the dead one's hers. And so these women, if you can imagine this, they're arguing right in front of the king, in the courtroom with a pile of witnesses watching him. I don't know what Solomon did. This is early in Solomon's reign, so he's in his early 20s. I don't know if he said enough, but he says, according to Josephus, bring me the babies, which would be the dead and the live baby. And then he says, I want a sword, probably to Benaiah, who's his right-hand man there. And he says, all right, divide both children in half and give half to each mother. Josephus tells us that the witnesses were just, they couldn't believe what they were hearing. They were laughing inwardly at this young, inexperienced king. What does he think he's going to do? He's going to end up with two babies. He's not going to solve this. But then you know the story. The real mother cries out and says, no, don't kill the child. It's better that the other woman have the child and it have her name rather than the child die. And Solomon says, don't kill the baby. Give it to the first mother. She's the true mother. And what did it say? Everyone was amazed at the wisdom of Solomon, and they knew his wisdom came from God. Following that, I asked you to go to Psalm 72. That just kind of struck me as interesting because we believe it was written by Solomon, and it talks about what a righteous king will do. And if you notice that in your group today, a righteous king doesn't just extend good judgments to the rich or to the important people or to the leaders. He must care for everyone, the poor, the needy, the children, and yes, even the prostitutes. And I found it exceedingly interesting that out of all the stories of Solomon's wisdom, the one we have deals with basically the dregs of society and how he showed wisdom to them. In that culture, kings wanted to be known as wise, and they actually kept records and documents of their trials, of the case, and their particularly wise rulings. And so Israel also did this. And I guess there's others that are available too, but this is the one that God has designed for us to see, that Solomon was wise with all class of people. Next, we go into his officials, and as we do today, when there's a change of leadership, each leader brings in his own cabinet. And I know you had fun with all these names today, didn't you? What it shows us is the wisdom of Solomon was not to totally replace his father's cabinets. Hopefully you saw some names that you recognized by now. There were Zadok and Abiathar. They were listed as priests. And you're going, now wait a minute, what happened? Didn't Abiathar get removed from office? Yes, he did. He was no longer a high priest, and he was banished to Athon, which was the city. He couldn't perform any duties, but he was still a descendant of Aaron, and he still had the title, even though he was not allowed to practice it. So at that point, Zadok and Abiathar still would be listed as priests. Did you notice who was listed as first? Azariah? Who's he the son of? Zadok. He's now the high priest, so we see there's another generation coming in here. We also have Benaiah. We know him. He replaced Joab as a commander-in-chief. He had been David's right-hand man for the bodyguard. Now he's Solomon's commander. Adoniram. We don't know about him, but he was mentioned at the end of David's reign as being in charge of forced labor. So maybe we'll talk about that a little later. Besides those, you will notice that there are sons of some of David's cabinet members. Nathan, the prophet, has two sons that are serving in Solomon's cabinet. After that, he created 12 districts. Interesting. This is an idea that Solomon came up with that is continued all the way through the New Testament time. We'd call them the IRS. Solomon, you see, is going to have this huge kingdom, and he's going to require all these supplies, as we see as the lesson continues. And how could he do that in a fair and equitable way? And so he decided to divide Israel into 12 districts. If you notice them, they're not districts that are based on the tribes, but they think they were probably based on population so that no place would be overtaxed. And he sent governors over each one of them. Now, these governors probably didn't have official positions prior to this. So this was a way of extending the leadership to all the tribes. Now, I was curious as to why he didn't have it divided on tribal lines. And there was some question with the commentaries on that. One of the commentaries said that maybe it was to break down the tribal unity because there was still a strong unit within the 12 tribes, but they needed to be one nation now. I don't know whether that is or not. I tend to think it was basically for the equity in order to supply the money and the support that he needed. Notice that with 12 districts, each one had 1 month that they were responsible to take care of the king. Following this in his daily rations, did you see those daily rations? I mean, 30 cattle, 100 sheep, not to mention all the wine, olive oil, and all the other things he needed every day. That's one big family. They think he actually served between 5,000 and 6,000 at his table every single day. And if you remember, a couple weeks ago, I said it was the king's responsibility for the army. So he had to supply what they needed as far as food when they were in his capital city. He also had charioteers. He also had pensioners. Remember Barzillai and his family? David had said to Solomon, you take care of him because he took care of me. So he had those type of people along with him as well. Plus, he's going to have a whole group of people that are going to come to see his wisdom, and he has to supply their needs too. So he served between 4,000, 5,000 every single day, and that's why there's such a huge amount that's needed there. What I want us to notice in verse 24, additional information is given regarding his kingdom. He now rules from Dan to Beersheba. We've seen this several times. Whenever we say Dan to Beersheba, we mean all of Israel. Dan's the top city, Beersheba's the southern city. So Dan to Beersheba means everything. It also includes the east and west borders. So Solomon is ruling all this. And in spite of all this, each man is living in safety under his own vine and fig tree. Think back to the time of Joshua. Everybody was given a land inheritance. Everybody except the Levites. But not everybody got to plant, tend, harvest, and eat their crops. Quite often they would plant, tend, and harvest, and the enemy would come in and take. But they're making a very specific point that at this time everybody could do everything, and they were eating the fruit of their own vine in safety. And the people were happy. Did you notice that? And everybody had enough, and the population was exploding. Nobody was dying in wars, and babies were being born, and it was just beginning to explode. It also tells us that Solomon has now acquired 4,000 stables, 1,400 chariots, and 12,000 horses. I don't know if any of you remembered back to Deuteronomy, but it said kings were not to acquire these things. And all of a sudden, we're starting to see them, aren't we? It doesn't make a judgment on it. It just simply says that Solomon acquired them. Now, God has given Solomon wisdom, and he also said he'd give him wealth. And up to this point, they were not allowed to have any modern technology because they would depend upon the technology and not upon God. But who had the chariots and the horses? Well, it was the Philistines, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Egyptians. Solomon now has conquered all his territory, and he's using the same technology that they have in order to keep his border safe and to keep those that he's conquered in line. In fact, he's got chariot cities where he keeps them. The bulk of Israel is mountainous. You can't run chariots there. But there are coastal plains, and now that he goes all the way up to the north and to the south, he uses the chariots to rule them. When we get down to verse 29, it says, his wisdom is becoming legendary even in his own time. It lists a whole bunch of wise men from the east. Mesopotamia was known for their wisdom. He also lists several names there, and it's unclear as to who they are. They may have been the wise men in his court, that he was wiser than them. Some feel that it was mythical people, and Jewish history says he was even wiser than Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, and that these names reflect that. I don't know, but what we do know is Solomon was wise, and his wisdom came from the Lord. He's given credit for all sorts of things. Hopefully you read it in your groups today. Proverbs, songs, also riddles, flora and fauna. Did that one surprise you? He knew everything about the flowers, about the trees, about the animals. He basically was an encyclopedia. And people came from all over the world, known world, in order to bring their questions to Solomon to have him solve it. And every time they came, they knew that the wisdom came from the Lord. Josephus tells us that Solomon even had zoos, parks, and gardens. In fact, the fragrant garden referred to in the Song of Solomon or the Song of Songs, they believe was just 9 kilometers outside of Jerusalem. near Bethlehem in a place called Etan. So Solomon really extended far more than we even read about in scriptures, but it's documented in history. Well, now we know Solomon for his wisdom, for his writings, because we have the Proverbs, we have Psalms, we have Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastics, and other things that Solomon has written. But in his day, the most important thing that he did was to build the temple. And because of that, the remaining chapters given to Solomon's life will deal with the temple. It symbolized the presence of the invisible yet present God in the midst of his people. And last week in chapter 3, it introduced the problem. You've got the tabernacle over here, you've got the ark over here. God said that you're supposed to worship 3 times a year at the tent of meeting. Everything's split up. People are worshiping at the high places. Solomon now is prepared to build the temple and bring all of this together. David had foreseen that this temple would be a magnificent temple. But it was Solomon's attention to detail that takes it, what we would say, over the top. It's not a very big temple. I think you're going to be surprised next week when we study it. And you saw today that it took 20 years to build the temple and the palace, and we're going, how can it take that long? Solomon took it to a magnificent level. David had prepared. He'd been in contact with the king of Tyre. He'd gotten cedars down there. He had skilled workers. But Solomon wanted even more beauty. Chapter 5 then opens up with the king of Tyre contacting Solomon. Now, the king of Tyre is a fascinating man. If you look at Israel here, you can see this little triangle right here. I want you to keep in mind, we've got superpowers, Assyria, Persia, Babylon over there. We've got Egypt down here. Phoenicia runs right along the border above Israel there. Tyre and Sidon are the two major seaports of Phoenicia. What's unique about Israel is how you get from the superpowers. You notice the trade route? Where does it go? Right through Israel. You see, whoever controls this little triangle here and this road has power to influence the entire world. Up in Tyre and Sidon was all the materials and the skilled laborers to build all the huge structures, palaces, temples. And any time that you wanted the best of the best done, you went to King Hiram. David had already done that, hadn't he? It's interesting because David and King Hiram had a relationship. It says they were friendly. It was more than a business deal because, you see, Tyre needs Israel. And Israel needs Tyre. Because Tyre and Sidon have to export what they have around the world, and the only way they can get there is to go through Israel. So it was a very important relationship between King David and between the king of Tyre. So when Solomon takes over now, the king of Tyre sends a congratulations to him. This is an open door for Solomon. Solomon knows he's going to be building the temple. He knows he needs what the king of Tyre has. And so he sends correspondence up to him. And Solomon does it in the proper diplomatic way. He addresses the king of Tyre, and then he talks about the relationship he had before with my father. And he talks about his father's desire was to build a house for the name of the Lord. Now, Hiram would have been familiar with this because he was supplying David with what he needed. Remember, David in the end of his life was preparing for the temple? It was Hiram that was supplying him with this. So Solomon says, you know that my father was planning on building a temple for the name of the Lord. And then he goes on to say that our God is above all gods. And this place has to be absolutely magnificent. But then he also tells him, but this temple is only for the name of him, because who can contain our God? Certainly not a man-made temple, certainly not the nation of Israel. Not even this whole earth can contain our God. Certainly not a king like I. And so then he goes on and says what he would like to do. And he says, I would like to extend the treaty that we have, the trade treaty. And this is the supplies that I will need. He says, I need more cedar, I need pine, I need amalgam, which is an ornamental wood that was used for furniture and for musical instruments. And he says, I'm also going to need skilled labor, which there is none better than Tyre and Sidon. And he says, and I will pay whatever the wages are. So the letter goes back up to Hiram, and he's delighted because without Israel, he can't trade. And so he sends word back down, praise be to this God, to God of Israel, who has seen in his wisdom to put David's son on the throne. He says he is the creator of all the earth. And the question comes up, does that mean that Hiram had accepted the God of Israel? And the answer is not necessarily. Because it was common practice whenever you went into another nation or when you went into a city that you would honor and respect their gods. And Hiram is part of Phoenicia, which is polytheistic. They have many gods, so one more doesn't make any difference. But he could very well have accepted the God of Israel too. We don't know. But he acknowledges that this wisdom came from God and he agrees to do this. The interesting thing about the wood, the cedar wood, is it only grew in Lebanon and it took hundreds of years for a tree to grow. It was 30 meters tall and it grew above 1,500 meters in height. But they had an abundance at that time. So Hiram says, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to cut down the trees. I'm going to tie them together in rafts and I'm going to float them down the Mediterranean. But what he's going to do is he's going to float it down the Mediterranean to a place called Joppa, which is right about here, right across from Jerusalem. And he says, then your men can unbundle them and take them the 35 rugged miles over mountains uphill to Jerusalem. He also says what it is he wants in wages. The difference between Kings and Chronicles in some of the numbers has to do with how they count them. But there was negotiations going back and forth, and I believe the numbers in Chronicles are actually what they were decided on. The wages that he wanted was food. You see, where he is on a seacoast, they have plenty of wood and plenty of skilled labor, but on a seacoast you don't have food. You can't grow it. And he was dependent upon importing food from other nations. And so at this point, he needs the food. Solomon needs the lumbers, and so they agree. Now, the amount of food that he's asking for is way over the top. He's asking for 3/4 of the amount that Solomon is getting. You know he doesn't need that much. And so it seems to be that he's actually exporting. He's taking it in different amount. It's barley, olive oil, and wine that he's requesting. Not animals, but he would be then exporting that and making money on that. So that's what Hiram was asking for. And then in typical business form, he said to Solomon, now do so quickly. Send me the year's wages and your men so we can get going on this. And so Solomon then sends it ahead. It's interesting because the amount between Solomon and Hiram for 20 years becomes a heavy burden upon Israel and is actually going to result in the impoverishment of a nation who should be building up. And we're going to see that as we go along. Again, these are just little indicators to watch what's coming ahead. Well, in addition to what Hiram supplies, Solomon is going to need skilled laborers. He used forced labor. Did you notice that? Adoniram was ahead of forced labor. Forced labor is slave labor, and Israel was forbidden to do this. So where were they getting the slave labor? They were actually getting it from the people that they conquered. Think back to the time of Joshua as one example. They had gone into Jericho, they had conquered Jericho, and then they were going into the city of Ai, and some men came from a far distance. Remember, they were dressed with old clothes, and they came to the men and said, we've come from a far distance, we've heard of your great power, and we want to make a peace treaty with you. And they did. And then the next city that Joshua came to ended up being this very city. It was the Gibeonites. Well, they'd already made a peace treaty. They couldn't wipe them out. So Joshua said, all right, we've agreed before the Lord you will live. But from now on, you're going to be carriers and woodcutters. So they believed that these forced laborers were people like the Gibeonites who lived within the nation that had some sort of treaties or had been conquered. But they were not part of the nation. And so they were the slave labor that were responsible for this. But in addition to that, he also needs skilled labor. It was the skilled labor to build gold and silver and ornamentation, and we talked about that a little bit because God had forbidden Israel to make any graven images, so he didn't have the skilled laborers that they needed. And so he was requesting that. The gentleman that was sent by Hiram was an interesting man. He certainly had a lot of skills if you look at everything that he was asking for. But he had a father from Tyre and a mother from Israel. And that was particularly noted. I'm not sure why. Maybe he would know the importance of the tabernacle at that time, or the tent. Josephus has an interesting little side note regarding the king of Hiram. The relationship began between Solomon and Hiram on that day, and it extended all the way through their lifetime. And he says all the things that he's saying, Josephus, could be documented at that time by looking at the actual letters that were transported between Solomon and Hiram. So at that time, they existed in both Israel and Assyria. And Josephus says, go and look at these, and you can see that I'm not exaggerating. Everything I say is true. But the fun part was that he was talking about the intelligence of Hiram and Solomon. They enjoyed wagering and sending each other difficult problems to solve. And I thought that was kind of a fun thing. Who could challenge King Solomon in his thinking? Well, when I was trying to think through these stories and the importance of them, and trying to make sense of everything that was happening in today's lesson, what stood out to me so much was where God had placed Israel and the importance of Solomon's wisdom. I want us to really get this firmly implanted in our minds. In order to get from here to here, or even over here from Rome to Greece, to any of these places, you had to go through the main trading routes, which were through Israel. The Via Maris was the main trading route, and you can see where it goes. It goes through the very heart of Israel, and whoever controlled that had the power and the influence on the whole world. God chose to give Solomon great wisdom. Notice where they came from. All over the known world to see Solomon, to inquire of him, to hear him. God's purpose for Israel and for his kings was that through them the whole world would know that he alone was the true God. And so Solomon's wisdom was another way that God was drawing people into Israel to find out about who he was. I thought about us. Irvine could really be at the crossroads, couldn't it? There's not a nation, I don't think, that doesn't live here in Irvine in the form of one person or another. When people came to Solomon, they walked away shaking their head and saying, this came from the Lord. It's his God. He's awesome God. And I thought, I wonder if our churches, whether it's this church or the other churches that you're part of, stands as a standing stone to our God, saying, God lives there. And I wonder about our lives when we walk around. Do people look at us and shake their heads and say, you know, that's an awesome woman of God or a man of God? Do we have that same influence? Are we at the crossroads of culture? Yes. But do people look at us so that the world will know that our God is the one true God? It was certainly something that struck me this week.